Well, in view of recent events, speaking specifically of the last couple Paul Washer broadcasts, we thought it might be good to ask this question. Is it ever okay to critique another Christian or another denomination? Obviously, people are going to answer this differently. There is a group of people who would say they would look back to the 16th century as a model. They've read the Reformers' writings, Luther, Calvin, and so on. And they've read even the 16th century Reformed confessions. And what they find as they look back there is that there is plenty of open, honest, public criticism of other positions, whether they be a doctrinal position or another denomination's position, or whether they be a particular person's position. There are names named, and there is open critique and robust debate going on in the 16th century and on in the 17th century. So that's one model that people will look at. And it's not just Roman Catholics. It's often other Protestants. And then there's another model. And I would say that it's more contemporary model. And it's the model of saying, hey, look, we really believe in John 17. We really believe that the church ought to be one. And we think one way we can get there is by having ecumenical sort of conversations, and at the same time, we don't sit around calling each other out and having open public debates, because when we do that, that just exacerbates the problem, it draws tensions to the surface, and it's divisive. And so there are those who would say, no, we don't want to do that. We don't want to critique other people in the Reformed world, and we don't want to critique other people in broad evangelicalism, because we have a broader goal than being concerned about our own narrow concerns about our particular doctrines. We want the church to be united. So the question is going to be, is there a balance? Is it possible to offer open public criticisms of particular people, doctrine, or denominations, and yet still have an interest in promoting what we might think of as the greater good, the unity of the visible church? Or is the best strategy, is the best model, is it the most righteous thing to do when we see false doctrine and false preachers spreading their influence throughout the Reformed churches and evangelical churches? Is it just better for us to keep quiet, have the policy of mums of the word? Because, you know, after all, we have an overarching goal, which is unity. And the best way to achieve that is by minding our manners and not talking about these things and just being nice. Well, maybe it's not as simple as that, but we should ask the question, is it ever okay to critique? Is there a balance here? That means today we're talking about the last taboo. So grab yourself a double cheeseburger and settle in for some sinners and saints.
In an age of moral bankruptcy, political sleaze, and man-centered religion in a compromised church, we bring you a Bible-based 21st century Christian faith. This is Sinners and Saints, Theology with an Edge.
Well, thank you for joining us today again on Sinners and Saints. We're glad that you've joined our discussion. I hope that you find this particular topic somewhat riveting, asking whether Christians can really openly and publicly debate, whether they can point out criticisms of other people's teaching, other people's doctrine. It's a question that's obviously emerging because of recent events here. We published, posted up a couple of broadcasts about Paul Washer. We got all kinds of feedback, some of it affirmative, some of it just saying it was interesting. Other people were downright upset. Some people were even hostile. We provoked a range of emotions and opinions, and I think that's one thing that we should be trying to do. Not trying to be necessarily offensive. It's not a shtick. But what we are doing is we're talking about biblical truth and doctrine and how it applies to the life of the church from a confessional framework. And when we do that, we understand that it will cut through the divide. There will be people in evangelicalism and there will be people in the Reformed churches who will have different opinions about it. They'll say they don't like it because of the tone. They may say they don't like it because it's not very courteous and gentlemanly. Other people will like it because they're tired of false doctrine just being spread around. And probably some of the people who like the criticism model like it because it helped them grow out of false doctrine and being in false churches. So there's really a range of opinions I think we've encountered recently. But I'm also here working with an article that was just published recently at the Gospel Coalition by Reverend Todd Pruitt. He co-broadcasts Mortification of Spin with Dr. Carl Truman, the smartest man in the room wherever he goes. And he posted up a blog recently where he talks about the last evangelical taboo. And here's what he says. We can just pull this out and start working our way into the issue. He says, in an age when being nice is the highest value, publicly confronting error from a well-known Christian is perhaps the last taboo in contemporary evangelicalism. He says, I'm a pastor. I write things that a very small number of people hear and there read. I say things that a relatively small number of people hear. If I write or teach something that is an error, it ought to be corrected. In fact, if my brothers turned a blind eye to error in my teaching, then they have done a disservice to the church. That's a very interesting quote. At any rate, I think what he's doing, what Reverend Pruitt is helping us do, is engage this discussion. Is it just about manners? Is it about just politeness? Or is there a very important spiritual ramification involved in having public, open critiques of people who are spreading around false doctrine? That's the question we're going to talk about here on Sinners and Saints. And joining me, as usual, is my battle buddy, Reverend Adam Kalushian from Ontario United Reformed Church. And I am Pastor John Sawtell of All Saints Reformed Presbyterian Church in Brea, California. Is it ever okay to critique, Pastor Adam?
2 Timothy 2:25. In humility, correct those who are in opposition, if God perhaps will grant them repentance so that they may know the truth. Let's start there. The basic principle is that those who are in opposition to the truth must be corrected. Now, in this passage, the Apostle Paul does not assume that those who need to be corrected are not Christian. He only assumes and states that they are in opposition to the truth in some aspect of their teaching that or beliefs that they are promoting. The hope is that they would come to their senses and escape the snare of the devil, having been taken captive by him to do his will. So there is a command in the scripture for those who are servants of the word, ministers of the word, to correct those who are in opposition. Of course, the context here is that Paul is instructing Timothy about some of the manner in which that should be done. He should avoid foolish and ignorant disputes, knowing that they generate senseless, unnecessary strife, and that servant who is going to correct those in opposition must not be, he says, must not quarrel, must not be unnecessarily negative or divisive, but be gentle to all, able to teach, and patient, and humble. One of the things that I find interesting, Pastor, is that some people interpret being quarrelsome, being arrogant, not being gentle, not being patient. That's defined as correcting someone in opposition. So you can't ever call somebody out. You can't ever speak strongly. Because if you do, that means that you're arrogant, mm-hmm. you're not gentle, you're not patient, and you're unnecessarily quarrelsome.
Pastor, it seems to me a rule of thumb here is the public nature of the discussion. The church is a visible church. It has, yes, we believe in the invisible component of the church as well, but we believe that there is a visible church. There is a body. There are individual congregations which are a part of that body. This involves, according to the ordinance of Christ, public preaching and public teaching for the purpose of discipling and teaching the saints. And, you know, that's the means of grace and operation is the preached word. So when things are said by people who have a public role in a public forum that affect many people in common, this is what we're talking about. And so an example here would be like Peter and Paul in the New Testament. When Paul found out that Peter was playing the part of a Judaizer in the churches, what did he do? Well, because of the public nature of the teaching, the public effect that it had, he went and attacked it publicly. In fact, it says, to the face he withstood him. And it indicates that there was, I bring this up because, again, people will say, even if they concede that it's okay at points to take on public teachers and offer public criticism, they always read this word gentle as if it sounded like you're dressed up like Barney and speaking in the most soft, placid tones. And yet Paul says he rebuked him sharply to the face in front of the people. Now, that cannot be inconsistent with his command to be gentle. So what I'm saying is often people, when they think of gentle, misunderstand what that has to do in terms of its application to how the critique is carried out. One, it should be public if the teaching is public. And number two, the tone, there can be a real tone of Paul was hostile to the doctrine because it was dangerous. It subverted the gospel. So he went after it. He went after it forcefully. And that is not inconsistent with gentleness.
Right. Well, and third, there is a progression that's implied in terms of the correction and the opposition to false doctrine. You know, the progression may start more toned down, more private in some cases. But when a person hardens themselves in some sort of false doctrine or false teaching and preaching or destructive teaching and preaching, then the heat needs to get turned up. So, mm-hmm. So now let me apply what I'm saying to a situation like, say, Paul Washer or whoever. What you have is people not who, for the first time in their lives, thought about the issues along the theological spectrum. And when they've been studying the scripture and studying theology, you know, just maybe accidentally fell into one camp because of instincts. These people are who they are and identify with the churches and the theological movements that they identify with because they have studied the issues, they have read the gentle, if you will, arguments on all sides of various issues, and they have come down in a certain area. And this identifies them. And so they are past the point in the progression of the congenial, private, hey, we're all disciples of Jesus Christ just trying to work on this together, to the point where they publicly come out and identify themselves with these distinctive views that are contrary to the scriptures. And therefore, it is past the time for private, nice, hey, come alongside me and let's figure this out. It's time for rebuke. And the hope is still that they will hear the rebuke from some corner and be corrected. But it's not wrong to make that public rebuke.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you bring up a principle here that's important as well. And I think the higher the public profile is of the person and the wider the scope and the influence and the nature of their position, if it really is a position of prominence and influence and somebody is considered a trusted teacher, as in the sense that Peter was as an apostle, the importance of the rebuke and the debate is even greater. Because from a human perspective, the more authority that teacher is perceived to have and the broader the influence they have, the more urgent the critique is, the need of the critique. Because the balance, the things in combination in terms of the gravity of the person and the way he is looked at with respect and plus the scope of the influence, it creates a situation where the damage done to the church is significantly greater. And so there is a need for this, and that's why you look across the New Testament. You find that the Apostle Paul warns Timothy about Hymenaeus and Alexander, who he has handed over to Satan. You find John complaining and isolating the individual Diotrephes who loved the preeminence you find Jesus reserving his sharpest critiques for who? With the Pharisees, the leaders of the church. And when you, I'm amazed when I read, you know, Christ's rebuke of the Pharisees, they're very firm rebukes. The words don't have just simply a light impact. They seem like they have a heavy impact. They feel like they're crushing bones with the words, if you will, because he is really powerful in his dialogue, in his rebuke of them, calling them hypocrites, and John calls them a pack of snakes, and you know, there's just not this really placid, tepid, calm demeanor, or even the words that are said are very strong words because of the concern about the damage that could be done to souls. So this is just, we're just starting our way into the critique, but you're looking at scripture, and what do you find this regularly? Even the prophets of the Old Testament, they go and rebuke the leaders of the church very openly, very sternly, very strongly, and they name names, and they name specific sins, and they name false doctrines. So you have a biblical pattern. In the Reformation, I was thinking of, you know this as well as I do, Pastor Adam, from the 16th century confessions. I'm thinking particularly of the three forms of unity. You regularly find phrases in there where individuals or whole doctrinal movements are named, and they're not spoken of with kid gloves, are they?
No, we detest the errors, right? So, I mean, the very, very strong language. Even in the pastoral, the warm Heidelberg Catechism, think about the strong language speaking of those who pray to saints. The calling out of the idolatry of the Mass.
An accursed idolatry, it calls it.
Yeah. So there are no punches being pulled. It's not like a theological egghead club where everybody who has a conviction and knows a little bit about the various views gets together and laughs about, oh, this one's a Calvinist, this one's an Arminian, this one that. No. These are serious matters over which churches, peoples have been divided, which obviously has clear implications for the spiritual well-being of the church and God's people. So it's assumed that the matters are such great importance that they should be clearly addressed.
Yeah, and done so with accuracy, with specifics, and that there is a reason at time to name names and movements and so forth so that people will know what you're talking about. Often what I've heard from people say, well, if you're going to critique, just speak in very general terms. And my response to that form of criticism, and I can appreciate it because it's somebody who's being thoughtful and they're concerned, and I appreciate all those things. But I could say this, look, the reason why this person is sunk in despair over assurance of salvation or is so confused doctrinally is because they read somebody in specific or they heard somebody in specific. And then when you keep running into individual after individual after individual who's had that same experience, not just here, but internationally and around the world, you begin to say that there is a real importance to address that so that everybody knows who's being spoken of. That person or that ministry, you better watch out, especially when high-profile, prominent Reformed people are saying, oh, yeah, this guy is... You know, we endorse his ministry. We love a lot of the things he's doing, great things. And yet people are listening to that very same person, and they're getting confused. And it's creating spiritual problems.
Yeah, I think one of the places that, to turn it a little bit here, right, where we would get critiqued for critiquing others is that people say, look, even if you don't state it explicitly, in some cases you are implying that the people you are critiquing are not Christians, right? So the rub, at least in theory, is not so much that critiquing is wrong and that expressing concerns, even strongly expressing concerns, is wrong, but that you're taking the position that those about whom you're speaking are not Christian. So by naming somebody's name and critiquing them very strongly, we are not saying that the person is not a Christian. That is a different question.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it may be that we don't or do believe somebody has a credible profession of faith and what have you, but that's not a component part of the critique, unless that's what we actually say. I think we're so sensitive to strong critique because we've never heard anybody critique anybody that strongly if they thought they were a Christian brother. But again, Paul and Peter are a great example.
Mm-hmm.
And Peter, no matter his position as an apostle, no matter his history, no matter his zeal for the Lord Jesus Christ, if he's found in opposition, has to be called out. And that doesn't say anything really about what Paul thought about the condition of his heart or whether Peter's confession of faith was now fundamentally compromised and Paul had to wrestle with all that. I mean, it's not the point.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to be able to separate those two things.
Yeah, Pruitt has a good point here along those lines where he talks about heresy is a technical category that is decided on by church councils. But correction is not to be reserved only for those who are guilty of heresy. That's the tie-in to what we're talking about here, because he makes a distinction between heresy and error. And he says one thing that we should be concerned about is correcting error before it becomes full-blown heresy. Hence, the public debates, the public calling out of particular people or doctrines, so that the error can, first of all, be corrected by the person who's teaching it and promoting it. And second of all, that a movement doesn't gather behind the error, and then with the mob growing, the intensity of devotion to particular items that are unbiblical or elements of a theology or a man's ministry that are unbiblical, we see this happen all the time in church history. Over time, as the mob grows, the elements get stretched out of all proportion, and pretty soon a false doctrine is beginning to get amplified so that it does turn into a full-blown heretical movement. And the point here that Reverend Prude is bringing up, I think, is a legitimate one, is to say, just because a person isn't teaching something that's full-blown heretical doesn't mean that we, at the same time, out of a concern for that person, out of concern for the church, don't address it head-on, because the error has the potential of becoming something really significant and damaging to the church. And he makes the point that if they're a public person with a high profile, there's no need to follow the biblical rule of private admonition. And this is what some people also want to say is, well, doesn't Matthew 18 say that you're to go to that brother in private? But this is not in the case of you observing somebody engaging in a secret sin or a private sin. This is somebody who is publicly disseminating a particular idea or doctrine or practice that is unbiblical. And he says then it's absolutely unnecessary to go have that private conversation because the record is public. So there's a difference. And I think that's a helpful distinction that you might wrestle with a little bit if you're concerned about this issue and wondering how you ought to think about it and process this debate, is right here, as he says, the distinction between error and heresy, and it's still important to confront error, and whether it's a public and private person or in a public or private statement. And those are critical. When we come back after the break here, we want to continue on this topic. There's another element of this discussion, and interestingly enough, it actually bears upon Reverend Pruitt and Dr. Carl Truman again. There's another article that's been recently published by a Baptist taking them to task. It's kind of an interesting article. I think there's some things in there that will be useful for our discussion as we continue to think about this topic of the last evangelical taboo. So don't go away. We'll be right back after the break.
One of the worst things that the Israelites in Babylon had to suffer through was hearing reports from the homeland for those who were left in the land of how they were being slaughtered by all the enemies of God and how the temple itself was being infiltrated by all kinds of idolatry and people from foreign nations coming in not to honor Israel's God, but to bring in the names of false gods and offer their sacrifices to them in the temple and then to destroy the temple and kill everyone.
Hi, my name is Adam Kalustian. I'm pastor of Ontario United Reformed Church, and I invite you to worship with us on Sundays at 10 a.m. and 5:30 p.m. When you come, let me tell you what to expect. Biblical worship and expository preaching centered on the glorious gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ and his call to live in obedience to his commands. Simple, no gimmicks, old school, historic Protestant religion. If you live in Ontario, Chino, Upland, Rancho Cucamonga, anywhere out there, you got to get in here and visit us.
You are more than welcome. We've been here over 85 years. We don't plan on going anywhere, and we would be privileged to serve you. Check us out on the web, OntarioURC.org. Your Spanish-speaking friends, family, neighbors, bring them too. They can worship at 10 o'clock in the Spanish language service with my colleague, Pastor Ruben Cernas. We'll see you Sunday at Ontario United Reformed Church.
Being a Christian today is not easy at all. From every side, Christians experience a relentless attack on their beliefs about God and His absolute unchanging word. Outside the church, secular humanism is working hard to challenge the very concept of truth, while inside the church, too many diminish the significance of biblical truth by focusing on music and entertainment rather than careful teaching of the Bible. In a culture dominated by the influence of unbelief and doubt, you need solid ground for your faith to rest on, and that solid ground is preaching and teaching of God's inspired and inerrant word. Hi, I'm Pastor John Sautel, and I want you to know that I understand your struggles, and that's why I'm inviting you to All Saints Reformed Church, where God and His worship come first, and where His word is taught verse by verse. For more information about All Saints Reformed Church, check us out on the web at allsaintsreformed.org. Come experience the renewal of your faith through expository preaching and biblical worship. Okay, we're back here after the break on Sinners and Saints, and once again, we're really glad that you've joined us listening to the podcast. I just wanted to take a moment to highlight the fact that we do have a new website. We had been promising for quite some time a rollout of a website. You got to go check it out. Our producer has done some really nice work there, putting the website together. It's going to be a great place where the shows are going to, where you can go download the shows and engage the discussion. And we are really grateful for the discussion, even when we don't agree with it. I have to say that it was really stimulating to interact with a lot of the Facebook comments and to join the debate. There are many voices that are wanting to be heard. I think the discussions that we're trying to raise here are not trivial. They are important questions because they're impacting the life of the church. Not just evangelicalism, but the topics we try to bring up, we think have an intersection with the current confessional Reformed and Presbyterian church situation. And so these are vital issues, and we need a place to talk about them and not just have wimpy conversations. We need to have full-blown debates. Somebody's right, somebody's wrong. And that's why the debate is essential to have, because once the debate has happened, we've determined which position is right or wrong. We can shut the door on this other stuff. When it's garbage, we're just going to say it. It's dangerous, it's poisonous, it's false, it's wrong. So to knock it off, let's get this out of our churches. And anyway, we're on this discussion today, the last taboo of evangelicalism, borrowing the language from Reverend Pruitt, who, by the way, has just recently switched over from a Baptist background. I think he might have been in a sort of a non-denominational church, and he joined the PCA. Now he pastors a PCA church back east and does this broadcast mortification of spin with Dr. Carl Truman. And they were just talking about his transition to the Presbyterian church and some of the reasons why he did it. I thought it was, for the most part, benign. It certainly wasn't malicious. He was just relating his own experience. He grew up in the SBC, talked about his experiences. And it sounded like he had a reasonable understanding of how things worked within that Southern Baptist tradition. And yet somebody who was listening to that broadcast got really upset. The guy's name is Tom Chantry. And so he posts up his own article. Pastor Adam, what's the name of that article there?
A Dispatch from the Realm of Non-Existence.
Ooh, it sounds fiery. Yeah. And it's posted up Reformed Baptist website. And he starts off complaining, saying, I just found out, I was listening to this broadcast, I found out yet again, or I was reminded once again that I don't exist. And so it's kind of self-loathing and whiny a little bit. But he does bring up some good points. And one of the points that, he just slammed it. I guess somewhere in the discussion between Truman and Pruitt, I think it was Truman that said, one thing that we've done a good job with in the Reformed churches is avoiding the personality cults.
Yeah, let me read the quote. So Chantry quotes either Truman or Pruitt, but probably Truman. We have by and large avoided the personality cults. There are one or two big names in the PCA, but what strikes me about things like the SBC is that for all of the fact that they repudiate Presbyterianism and they repudiate Episcopalianism, they are functionally Episcopalian. Maybe this was Pruitt, I don't know. But anyway, because they vest great power in significant individuals. What I like about Presbyterianism is that that power which you have outside your congregation is regulated by rules and procedures and other people. It isn't just rooted in the charismatic personality.
So this is like pretty stinging what he says here. Obviously, you know, this is what he's saying happens in Baptist churches, is that you people, this is said by a Presbyterian now, you people, you Baptists are the ones who are pushing this this individualistic spiritual experience that is facilitated by a high power, charismatic individual. And so his response is, it's funny. He says, "Gentlemen, let me close with a story. A few years back, I got word of a seminary classmate of mine who had taken up a pulpit in a new church not far from me. I had lost track of him, and I wanted to know what he was up to, so I went to his church's website. On their front page, I found the following statement: we are a church founded on the ministerial philosophy of Tim Keller of Redeemer Presbyterian Church in New York. Zap! And then he talks about, he goes, he's digging through the website. He can't find anything about their doctrine or their theology. But he knows that they're a church founded on the principles of Tim Keller. Of course, you guys all know that this is the Master Yoda of the church growth movement in the PCA. And he's in New York City. And a lot of people like Tim Keller's books, and they go to his conferences or whatever. And he's going, yeah, you're right. You don't have any bishops. You don't have any personality cult people within the Reformed and Presbyterian. It was a nice little dig, I thought. And I thought, yeah, it was a fair criticism.
Oh, absolutely. Whether it was Truman or Pruitt who said this, I can't believe they said that with a straight face and a clear conscience. I mean, part of me wonders if this is taken way out of – you heard the podcast, but part of me wonders if it was taken out of context and they were being sarcastic.
No. This was Truman saying.
Are you kidding me? Saying he said the Reformed and Presbyterian world has avoided the personality cult by and large? What a joke that is. And absolutely. The first thing I thought of when he pointed – this chantry guy pointed out Keller is – look, I'll say this for Keller. Yeah. Maybe you like him or not. He's a pastor.
Right.
And in the context of that, he's trying to work his program in an ecclesiological context.
Not in a parachurch ministry.
In a parachurch ministry, which is what, I mean, that's clearly an issue in terms of the personality called in the Reformed and Presbyterian world. Even if you want to argue that that parachurch organizations are legitimate, you can't tell me that in the Reformed and Presbyterian world, you know, Ligonier Ministries, Whitehorse, and whatever, that personality cult is not an issue, even if you want to argue that it is not the personalities themselves who are promoting the cult. This is, you know, hero worship is as much of a problem in the Reformed and Presbyterian world as it is in any religious context.
Yeah, especially so in the last 20 years or so. I think that Carl Truman, if he had said this, speaking of the Reformed and Presbyterian church prior to this, would probably have a decent point. But it's not that way anymore. And one reason why it's not that way anymore is because in the Reformed and Presbyterian world, the confessional and conservative one, we have basically tried to emulate and model what was going on in evangelicalism because it looked successful.
Yeah. Well, and okay. I mean, even on a more basic level, you know, anytime you have charismatic men who are influential and winsome, you know, there's going to be the accompanying temptation in their case to promote themselves in a way that goes beyond the bounds of, you know, promoting the good work and teaching that they're doing. And you're going to have the temptation on the part of their hearers who identify with what they're saying and are learning and growing from them to exalt them higher than they ought. And that's not just on the broader level, but that happens in every local church, you know, where people are affectionate with their pastor and this kind of stuff too. Yeah. So, I mean, my point is just that there's no difference in terms of the temptation and the reality of hero worship in a small church, a big church, influential people, you know, less gifted people. I mean, this is just a reality. And I think I agree with Chantry that it's almost laughable that you pointed the SBC as having that problem, but that we don't see it in our own circles.
Yeah, it's almost ubiquitous now in our circles, and it's lamentable, and That's one of the principles of Sinners and Saints, by the way, is to crush the personality cult and the parachurch organization. And by the way, if you want to say, well, what are you guys? Well, this is Sinners and Saints is a ministry under the direct oversight of the elders of All Saints Reformed Presbyterian Church. It is not a parachurch ministry model at all. And one of the things that we're saying is we ought to be building the ministry out of the local church and under the authority of the elders, so that if there are accountability issues, they can be handled within the context of the church and its courts, not under a board of directors, by and large, which people are find a position on because they have deep pockets.
So I was amused by that. But the main point of the article was Chantry just was whining. You know, he was whining and complaining that, think of the title of the post again, right? A dispatch from the realm of non-existence. And what he means by that is that particular Baptists who trace their roots to the particular Baptists in the 17th century are getting lumped in with all of the other Baptists, in this case, the Southern Baptist Convention. And so they are assuming that we have the same ecclesiology. And I'm tired of getting lumped in again with all these other Baptists, as all the critiques of us Baptists tend to do.
Yeah, and if you listen to the broadcast, the point that he's responding to, but the point as it was made was this, which is that they were saying that there's such a broad spectrum of belief and practice within the denomination, say, such as the SBC, that you can have everything from five-point Calvinists to hardcore Universalists. You can have women preaching. You can have you can have people who don't believe in basic fundamental articles of faith, and yet, and it's a theological free-for-all in some sense. And they made the point that a lot of Baptist churches are basically 5 minutes away from being entirely what they were not yesterday, because one pastor could come in with his particular theology, if it be Orthodox or conservative. And if he goes on, or they add some more members of the church who don't agree with his standpoint, it can be all swept out tomorrow. And they said that seems to be the only galvanizing factor that holds these coalitions together is their commitment to not baptize children, their commitment not to follow through with the implications of covenant theology. And it seems to be that the single unifying feature of their movement is that they reject infant baptism of believers and they hold to so-called credo baptism. Well, Pastor Adam, what historical group made that the issue?
Could it be the Anabaptists?
Yeah, I think that's historically. Actually, I mean, to whine about being traced to the 17th century, to being lumped in. Look, you are doing this on your own. Self-consciously, you are choosing to unite with people who hold no theology that's similar to yours because of this one issue. And the only place you can find that in church history is the Anabaptist movement. So you are heirs of that tradition. You should just be honest about it, own it, be proud of it.
Okay, so you have a radical discontinuity in your ecclesiology and other significant things. Great. But on like your fundamentally identifying distinctive and mark, you have that in common with all of these Baptistic traditions that you're complaining you're getting lumped in with. It's just the reality of it, friend. Okay, you're a Baptist. And own it.
Well, you should be proud of it. I don't understand why you want to be Reformed anyway. Why do you want to be regarded as Reformed when your whole existence for your identity, your ecclesiastical identity, is what you reject something that's fundamental to being Reformed? I mean, why does it matter to you if you get to be a part of the Reformed club when you reject Reformed doctrine?
Yeah, I don't know what this guy thinks overall about that.
No, he says it in the article.
He wants to be Reformed.
He doesn't like it that he doesn't get to be a part of the Reformed group. He basically is arguing here that they think all Baptists are alike, and they ought to realize that there are plenty of Reformed, if you will, Baptists.
He's
saying the Reformed have been
Truman
denying our
Pruitt,
existence for at least a decade now.
Yeah, refuse to admit that there's any variation in Baptist experience, and that's beyond disappointing. I don't know of anyone who doesn't admit that there is variation in Baptist experience, that there is no such thing as particular Baptists in the 17th century or whatever. I think the problem is, from the perspective of those who consistently practice Christian baptism, you know, it's a pretty big deal when you don't do that, right? So that tends to stand out among all of your other convictions and similarities and dissimilarities with various, you know, strands of the Christian church. Okay, I mean, this is kind of the big deal, right?
Well, Pastor, let's just quote from our own confessional tradition. See why it is an issue. Westminster Confession of Faith, chapter 25, defines the visible church as believers who profess the true religion and their children. And then at another point, the confession says it's a great sin to neglect baptism. Now, they're not talking about people who, at that point in the confession, they're not talking about people who claim to be Christians but don't get baptized. They're referring to Baptists who don't baptize, to Baptists who refuse to baptize their children. And they say it's a great sin. So it was a dividing line between them. They didn't view you as Protestant. They didn't view you as part of the visible church. That's there. How about the Belgic Confession?
One of the marks of the true church is the legitimate administration of the sacraments. The legitimate administration of the sacraments. We detest the error of those who not only deny the once-for-all baptism that is commanded by Christ, but those who refuse to administer that that sacrament to the children of the covenant. Now, of course, their response... I mean, I can read it without reading it. Chantry's going to say, well, that's an anachronistic argument because they're not speaking about Reformed Baptists. This is the argument that typically comes when you argue from the Belgic Confession, say, right? There's no such thing as a Reformed Baptist back then, so you can't apply the rhetoric and the categories to the Reformed Baptist today. But what that misses is that the critique in the confession zeroes in on the difference in the sacrament of baptism.
Right.
So there may be other – in other words, there is not just one mark of the – there are three marks of the church. One of them is the legitimate administration of the sacraments. That mark is distinguished from the other ones. If you don't meet that mark, then you don't have the status of the true church. But all that to point out that – from our confessional traditions, the sacrament of baptism is central and significant. So if you do get lumped in with the other Baptists, that's perfectly legitimate.
But if, but if you also consciously choose to unite with that group for the one reason that you reject infant baptism, then why don't you just – there's no reason not to acknowledge it. You have – your continuity is not with the Reformation. It's with the Anabaptists. It's a counter-Reformation in a sense because it wasn't a part of – the magisterial Reformation, and you're choosing to identify with them on the most identifying feature that held them together was their rejection of this, and that's what you're doing. I'm sure there were people at the time of the Reformation who would have held to, let's say, the 5 points of Calvinism, if we could use that anachronistically, who yet still rejected infant baptism, and they were rejected by the magisterial reformers as not being a part of the Protestant church. And if they're doing that today, why should there be a different way to categorize them? But he talks about here, and this gets us into this question, he wanted them to deal with the issue of infant baptism. So another one of his critiques he had is, hey, if you're going to bring this whole topic up, at least defend your golden calf of infant baptism. That's not his language, by the way. That's Paul Washer's. He calls infant baptism the golden calf of the Reformation. And, you know, he brings up a challenge here. He says they need to address the question of baptism thoroughly, biblically, and without reference to needlessly vapid philosophical terms. Now, I thought that was interesting. He wanted them to address it without vapid philosophical terms, Pastor Adam. And I was trying to wonder what those terms could be.
Well, technically, he's just saying to paint us in such broad brush and to pretend that we don't exist, the particular Baptists, it shows that they're probably – you know, scared of anybody really seriously engaging them on the doctrine of baptism. Because after all, the particular Baptists, unlike maybe some uneducated, you know, theologically immature Baptists of the other strands of Baptists in the world and in church history, we actually have the compelling argument,
mm-hmm.
and they don't want to have that debate with us. So it's easy to just pretend we don't exist. But yeah, it is interesting, the language, right?
Yeah,
thoroughly biblically and without reference to needlessly vapid philosophical terms. So we were laughing off air, like, what does that mean? The term covenant, or what could it mean? What argument do we use
the
with
continuity
a vapid philosophical
of the signs?
Term to, as a rhetorical trick to defend something that we know is not true, or
I'll just defend Truman and Pruitt. I don't think the point of their show was to defend or promote infant baptism. They were just talking about different implications of the implications of the switch from being a Baptist pastor to the Presbyterian Church. That's all he was talking about. Maybe they should have talked about infant baptism some more if they had a chance. But I do like this, Pastor Adam. I do like it when guys on the Baptist side of the argument take their position seriously. And they call you out if you're Reformed, and they say, for instance, it's devilish conduct, like MacArthur says, or Paul Washer, he calls it a golden calf, means we're engaging in idolatry, or this guy here demanding a debate about it, because at least it's an honest position. You're saying this is a very, very real difference between us, and just sitting around having tea and crumpets in a polite conversation isn't going to deal with it. It is a massive difference. You can't unite together as brothers in the visible church without agreeing on this topic. So the challenge is important.
Right.
We can't just sweep that under the rug.
Yeah, I think I maybe talked a little bit about this on one of the back and forths on the Facebook post a couple of weeks ago on Paul Washer One show. But, I mean, think about the implications. I mean, you know, you basically, from a Baptistic point of view, believe that many of those in the Reformed and Presbyterian world are not baptized.
You're not Christians.
Yeah.
You
well, that would be the implication.
You
of
can't
it.
Have I mean, the I Lord's people, Supper in their church. You cannot be a member of their church.
If they practice it consistently.
Well, most of them do, though.
Yeah, well, I don't even know.
Yeah, most Baptist churches required. I mean, I've known of people.
My point is that the theology, whether or not people practice it consistently, the theology requires,
right,
that you to believe that person is not baptized. And what category do we have in the Bible for somebody who is not for a Christian who's not baptized? I mean, apart from somebody who converts like on their deathbed, like the thief on the cross or something, but
they're not a Christian.
Yeah. So the implications of this are very weighty.
Yeah.
Going back to our original point that, you know, it's okay to, you know, shoulder to shoulder. I'm a 5-point Calvinist, but I'm a Baptist. I'm 5-point, but I baptize children. I mean, whatever. But if you think about
dry clean and you sprinkle,
you know. But if you think about the nature and the implication of this disagreement in this area, it is much more sobering, and it calls for serious confrontational address and debate, and we can't shy away from that. Whoever is in opposition to the truth needs to be corrected, and those who are following the side that is not correct need to be called to repentance.
Yeah, it's a serious deviation doctrinally. If the Reformed are wrong, it's a serious, serious deviation. If the Baptists are wrong, it is a serious deviation. And this is why I believe we have to take these charges for what they are. They are very important charges against us, and that's why we have to defend our position. And you can't – after you do, you know, so often the case that Reformed people get mad, they get upset, but because they think it sounds unloving or uncharitable or unkind, but – we have doctrine here. You're wrong if you're presenting your child for baptism as in their infancy. You're dead wrong. To the Baptist view, looks at you as you've committed gross sin. So we have to defend the position, and I think he's fair to call it out. And I think that more of this should happen instead of these very lame, empty dialogues. We have to engage, and I think that means that Reverend Pruitt is correct when he talks about this being the last taboo. You can't call it out. And he said this should not be a taboo in our midst. As Christians, we ought to be quite willing to engage in vigorous debate if need be when there are significant points of difference in doctrine, and do our best to clarify those and to win those who don't agree with us to our position. And so debates are necessary, but there is a balance. We want to thank you for joining us today on Sinners and Saints, and we really do look forward to hearing your feedback. Thank you for joining us today, And stay tuned for more topics that we'll tackle here from God's Word and the Confessions of Reformed Church on Sinners and Saviors.